Welcome to The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturalist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, you're listening to The Informed Gardener podcast, and I'm Linda Chalker-Scott. That long-winded title you just heard just means I take information from science articles that have to do with plants and soils, and then I translate it so you can use it in your garden. So each week, I'm going to stretch your mind a little bit by showing how you can use plant and soil science in your garden to save time, money, natural resources, and even your back. The information I'll share is always based on scientific research that either I've done, or my colleagues have done, or someone else in the university profession has done. And then I try to follow some kind of theme on my podcast. So today's theme is garden concoctions. I'm going to tell you about garden peas, and it's not what you think. It's not necessarily a vegetable. What slugs have to say about microbrews, and you might be very surprised with what they have to say about microbrews. And finally, why tea is better part of your breakfast than a part of your garden. And what would a garden podcast be without a field trip to a garden? So we're going to head outside to Sue's Creek Botanical Garden in Auburn, Washington, and talk with landscape designer and owner Maurice Skagen about the 23-acre garden paradise he's created over the last 30 years. But first of all, let's look at garden concoctions in the news. The first little item I found from the news comes from Bangor Daily News, and it has to do with slugs and beer. And as you might wonder, what's better on a hot summer day than ice-cold beer? According to slugs, not very much. Now, we had a really wet spring here in the Pacific Northwest, as did much of the country, and summer hasn't been much better. The slugs are loving it, and not only do they love the weather, they love our gardens. But there was an interesting article that came out in the Bangor Daily News about slugs and beer. This was actually an experiment. It wasn't a scientific experiment, but the person who did it tried several different beers to find out what slugs might like to drink best. And if you're not familiar with slug control and using beer, basically what you do is you take a pie pan, you fill it full of beer, you put it outside, the slugs crawl in, they get drunk, and they die. It sounds really grim, but it works really, really well. What she found was that slugs aren't really much for microbrews. They don't really care for Canadian beers. They don't even like Guinness. They don't like Corona. What they love is Budweiser. Budweiser is definitely the king of beers in Slugville. This next little tidbit that I dug up actually comes from the Garden Professor's blog archive, and I'll tell you at the end on how you can access that archive and read more about this particular topic. And this is peas in your garden. And as I said before, it's not the vegetables that you're going to be thinking about after you finish hearing this little tidbit. You can think of this as a gardening version of News of the Weird. And the story comes out of England, where gardeners at a National Trust estate, which I think is pretty much like the national park system we have here in the United States, constructed a 10-foot-long straw bale. And this wasn't meant to be a smorgasbord for horses or cows or deer or any other of the grazers, but it's actually an outhouse for the gardeners. So when nature calls, the male gardeners call upon the bale, cleverly named a pea bale. And yes, they pee on the bale. And it's not just to save 30% of their water from flushing the loo, or toilet as we would call it, although they do have that water savings, but the main reason they're doing it is so they can use this straw bale for compost. What urine has in it, it's got water, it's got nitrogen, it's a wonderful kickstart for a compost system. And frankly, I think that guys just like peeing outside. When the bale is finally broken down to compost, it's a very rich organic matter. It gets spread out over the gardens as a natural type of fertilizer. They construct a new bale, and it's there to answer the door when nature calls. And if you want to read more about these pea bales on the Garden Professor's blog, just go to the website and look for the November 16, 2009 archive. Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, today we're visiting Sue's Creek Botanical Garden in Auburn, Washington. This 23-acre living plant museum is the brainchild of landscape designer and owner Maurice Skagen. Earlier this week, I visited with Maurice and his partner James Daly, and I asked Maurice how his vision for this garden was born.
I had an aunt who was a true gardener. At the time, I remember she was living in Emaglon, where the soil is quite good, and she just had this lovely garden around her farmhouse, and I was fascinated with her use of color. And she acquired most of these plants through exchanges with other farm wives. They called them slips at that time. They would exchange these plants or cuttings or divisions. Then she moved to several other homes and repeated this. And toward the end of the life, she lived across the street from me when I was building this residence. And she started bringing things over. And then got even more interested because, oh, she said, you'd have to have this. And, and she was so fascinated by what I was doing that really was the inspiration initially. And then I guess from there, I just kept going. And a few trips to England and Japan really inspired me because of their, not all their gardens, but many of their gardens have this concept where you sort of stroll from place to place and not always in really well-developed garden spaces, but nicely kept and with lots of open space. And I think that was the idea, and I knew that I couldn't have 100 gardeners like the English did at one time, but I thought, well, I could have paths and places where people could walk. And I was thinking mainly people who live nearby, that as this area developed quite quickly in the 80s and 90s, where they could walk and have a peaceful, perhaps attractive place to be in.
Tell me about this pond, which is what struck me when we first walked in last week when we had that lovely reception here and saw this pond, and I was immediately drawn to it.
I started planning early on, and I discovered a lot of things wouldn't grow in that area because it was sort of a natural springy area, and plants that didn't care for high moisture wouldn't survive there. So I decided to scoop it out and sort of create a pond that would collect runoff water, basically. And then our ongoing problem, of course, is to keep it, the water retained as much as possible, and we recirculate a bit. And but that's how it got started, because it was a wet spot. Wetland.
Take advantage of the wet spot, yeah.
Yeah, took advantage of the wet spot.
Well, it's just great with the all the lilies and the rushes and the irises and lilies along the edge and just all kinds of water-loving plants. And it's just a wonderful pond. It looks like it's been here almost for centuries. It doesn't look like it's only, what, 15 years old?
Well, it probably goes back 30, do you think? But one interesting thing about the pond, I planted some irises on the bank, and it fascinated me because they just walked down the bank into the water. I didn't think that, I thought that they were ones that wouldn't live in water, but they thrived even better in the water. So I sort of let nature take its course in that respect. And the birds I see have recently deposited some new plants too, such as the cattails, which I never have had until the last year or two. So I didn't plant them myself, I know that.
Well, that's, for me, one of the best ways of gardening is letting nature take a hand in it, because then you end up with things that really like where they're planted.
The conditions.
And as long as they're not noxious weeds or something like that that you don't want, I think that's a lovely way to get a garden to grow on its own. So you mentioned not wanting to have an army of gardeners, but you've got 23 acres. And before you had all these volunteers, how did you take care of everything?
Well, apparently I was blessed with a strong set of knees, because I still don't use knee pads. And I crawled around on my knees. But I started with the concept of getting the larger trees and shrubs in first that were easier to care for, because they grow more quickly. And that sort of established a structure. And I sort of thought, well, if grasses grew up around them or weeds, it won't be that bad a thing. And then later I would fill in with smaller things that needed more attention.
Well, and it sounds like, as you said before, you're gardening with nature. You're letting a lot of things that do well on their own in our climate kind of take over, and they kind of keep the care down, because you don't have to give them a lot of TLC when they're things that are adapted to your site. Well, one thing I have noticed, because I always look for all things mulch, is that you use wood chips underneath your trees and shrubs, which I am really happy to see.
So is this stuff that you bring in from other sources, or do you have enough stuff that you chip it up yourself, or what do you do about your mulching?
Well, we've been very fortunate because there's a man who has a tree cutting service, and he was being charged to take it to a recycler, and we suggested he bring it here, and he's been doing it faithfully, and it's a nice mix of green and dry, so it should be very good for the soil. Because prior I wasn't that careful with weeds. I tried to keep the worst down, but you know, I have a few that are really difficult to deal with.
What are some of the weeds that are problems?
I think my worst one is ranunculus or buttercup. Because that has such a tenacious root system.
And it loves those wet soils that are close to your pond.
And if you don't really get it all out, or you even let it lie, it seems to re-root real quickly. There's another plant called penstemon, the native penstemon that grows quite tall and weedy. And that one is always is present. And grasses, of course, that creep in and grasses that infiltrate into irises and that sort of thing.
So I'm also curious about what this all looked like before you put the first shovel in the earth. Okay. What was this whole area like?
Well, it was interesting because the property, this was part of 160 acres that was acquired by my great-grandfather in 1890. Of course, it was tall fir trees and cedar trees, the fir trees being as tall as 300 feet, and they hacked their way through it and made enough clear land to a farm, dairy farm. So when I started gardening in the 60s, they had quit farming by then. It was getting overgrown with young alders, and so I removed those alders and then left a lot of the firs and cedars, then started to plant. I had acquired, like some of these Cynthia rhododendrons, I had acquired about 1960, and then Cedrus deodoras and things like that that I had had from that period, so I guess they're about 50 years old. The little creek down below does have four runs of salmon in the fall.
Oh, wow.
In mid-October. Because the fish hatchery is, this Seuss Creek joins Green River a couple of miles from here, and there's a hatchery there, and they release both wild and farm-raised salmon.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was your aviary and the birds, which we've heard a little bit from as we're speaking here.
As a kid, this goes back a long ways, I was fascinated with chickens, and I had a little chicken project and raised it, sold eggs and that sort of thing. And I've always been fascinated by the beauty of birds, and that grew into wanting to have different kinds. And I learned from the Woodland Park Zoo that you could have a lot of almost semi-tropical birds year-round if you start them off early in the spring, like in May, outside, and they acclimatize gradually.
And
Just like plants. That's exactly right. So when October and November come along, they don't seem to mind as long as they're not wet, as long as they stay dry. And so I don't know. I've got parakeets and cockatiels and doves and quail and pheasants and peacocks and chickens and a few other things out there. But since we've been open this last 10 days, it's been interesting to me that children are so attracted to the aviary because there's something about nature and wildlife or domestic fowl or whatever that fascinates them. And so we're going to try to enhance the visibility of that.
That was Maurice Skagen, owner and designer of Seuss Creek Botanical Garden. You can find more information, including visiting hours, at seusscreekbotanicalgarden.org. And Seuss Creek is spelled S-O-O-S Creek and the rest of it just like it sounds. We've included some pictures from the garden on the Garden Professor's website as well. Every week on this podcast, I look forward to answering some of your gardening questions based on our theme of the show. Since today's theme is garden concoctions, I thought compost tea would be a perfect topic. This is one thing I get a lot of email questions about. But for those of you that have never heard of compost tea before, let me tell you a little bit about it first. What it is really just like it sounds. It's compost plus water, and it brews. And this is something that your grandmother or great-grandmother or some other ancestor may have used as part of their natural way of watering their vegetable gardens. Every farmyard had a compost pile, and every compost pile has stuff that leaches out of it. So when it rains, all this nice black water comes out, and this is what used to be collected and used as a natural fertilizer. And as scientists, we call this stuff compost leachate or compost extract, which is not nearly as exciting as compost tea. Since your ancestors used this product, the compost tea, it's changed into something a little bit different and, in my mind, a little bit sinister. One of the things I like to do as a garden professor and as an informed gardener is to help people understand the difference between good products, bad products, kind of like a botanical version of Ralph Nader. So the compost tea that you might see now being sold either in nurseries or you find a service that will spray compost tea, it's a little bit different than what your grandparents might have used on their vegetable garden. What this is, it's a concoction that is compost plus water plus a lot of little additives, and the whole thing is put into an aerated system and air is bubbled through, and it's all very scientific sounding, and you get this product at the end that's called compost tea. And what proponents of this particular product claim is that it can be used as a fertilizer, which is true, it's a weak fertilizer. And more amazingly, you're told that it can also cure plant diseases. All you have to do is spray it on the leaves or spray it in the soil, and it will kill all the bad bugs, and you'll have nice beneficial bacteria and fungi there. And this is all fine and well, but the problem is it just doesn't work. At least it doesn't work consistently. And this is where the science part comes in and where we really have to separate science from anecdotes. And what an anecdote is, it isn't necessarily a remedy to poison. It's a story. It tells you how a product might work for a person. So I have a number of people who will email me and say, you know, I use compost tea and my roses have never looked better. It's so much better than last year when I didn't use compost tea at all. And as I said, that's great. If these things work for you, by all means use them. But as a scientist, I can't recommend things that aren't backed up by good science. And the problem with these anecdotal things is they're not scientific experiments. And rather than get really boring and tell you about how to run a scientific experiment, I'll just mention one thing, and that's control. Anytime you're trying to compare something to something that's not there, you have to have a control. So what I mean by that is if you are going to have a yard that has roses in it or whatever, and you want to test compost tea, what you have to do is split up your garden. Half of the garden you're going to spray with compost tea, and the other half you're going to spray with water. And then you can compare. And maybe you'll see some differences, and that's great. Then you can get a little bit more creative. You might try it another year. You might divide it up a little bit more and try different plants other than roses. Anyway, you can see how this evolves, that you have to try some different things and see if you consistently get the same result, that the compost tea results in a bigger, better-looking plant than something with just water. And that is where the science comes in. Anytime that we look at something from a scientific perspective, we're trying to test whether or not a treatment, and that would be, in this case, the compost tea, works better than the control. Again, in this case, that would be water. And this is the tricky part now. I can take two plants, and I can spray one with water, and I can spray one with compost tea. But the problem is, I know that one of them's been sprayed with water, and I know the other one's been sprayed with compost tea. And you know something? If I know which one I want to have come out better, I'm going to be looking at those plants a little bit differently. And this is where the important part about unbiased experiments comes in. If you're going to do this kind of experimentation, you have to do what's called a double blind. And that's just a kind of a long-winded way for saying you can't actually know what you sprayed onto your plants. Now, that sounds really confusing. How can you possibly, you know, tell what a product does if you don't know what you've sprayed? Well, as an example, let's say you wanted to test the compost tea on your own. So you have a bottle of compost tea and you have a bottle of water. And you give them to somebody else, and you say, mix these up and label them so you know which one's which, but make a label so I don't know what it is. And then I would go and spray those things. I would have no idea what I was spraying. And then when I went to look at the plants to figure out which ones were doing better, I'd have to be fairly open and honest with myself because I don't know which way I want it to come out. And that's how you get good, unbiased results. So to bring this all back to the science behind compost tea, for years, people have been studying compost tea to see whether or not it cures diseases, whether or not it results in bigger, better plants, And the problem is, it's just not consistent. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And the problem from a scientific viewpoint is, unless it's a consistent result that can be repeated by other scientists, it doesn't matter. So, as I said, if it's something that you believe in fervently, you want to use it, you like using it, makes you happy, go ahead and go for it and use it. But in terms of recommendations, I, the scientist, other extension people, any other professor is going to tell you they can't recommend its use without some kind of solid science behind it. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, theinformedgardener.com. That's my official WSU webpage, and it's full of free and great information. Second, I hope you'll join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog, and you can find us at gardenprofessors.com. The four of us take turns every day posting on just about any gardening topic you can think of, and even some that you probably haven't thought of. You can add comments, you can add questions, we always respond to those, and it's really a fun give and take among all of us. And finally, I've also published some books that might be of interest to you. One of them is The Informed Gardener. I mentioned it earlier. There's a sequel to that called The Informed Gardener Blooms Again. And finally, there's a great big book called Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. And for more information on those books, you can find them on sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I've hoped you've found this podcast and the others entertaining and useful. I welcome your comments and questions. You can reach me at lindacs@wsu.edu. And make sure you tune in next week when we take on plants and drugs and rock and roll.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener. For more information on Linda's books, future podcasts, as well as other stories and articles she's written, please visit informedgardener.com, gardenprofessors.com, or sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. Thank you to Large Media, executive producer and production direction, and the WSU faculty and staff. Happy gardening!